You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Jordan.
Hello, Bob.
How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Great to be here. Big fan of yours.
Oh, I'll bet you say that to all the guys, Jordan. But I'm a big fan of yours. Let me introduce this and explain why. So I'm Robert Wright, publisher of Non-Zero Newsletter. This is Non-Zero Podcast. You're Jordan Schneider, host of the China Talk podcast, which has become very prominent and I would say influential. So I'm very excited to be talking to you. And I've gotten a lot out of it. You recently had an interesting two-part conversation on Xi Jinping's father with the author of a biography on him that I found very interesting. The other reason I'm excited to talk to you is because I think you would say, and you can correct me right away if I'm wrong, but that you are a proud subscriber to what's sometimes called the China consensus in DC. Maybe not exactly. We'll see. But anyway, I'm like a long way from being a subscriber to it. So I'm interested in the presumably productive intellectual tension. We'll see here. You know more about China than I do. So maybe by the end of this, I'll just be, I'll be totally on your page. We'll see. How does all that sound?
Sounds great. Let's get into it.
Okay. Where are you, by the way, physically?
I'm in New York City.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I've heard of that. Okay. Brooklyn, are you cool or are you not cool?
No.
These are the same question.
I'm around Union Square.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Okay.
You look a little young for that. Shouldn't you be in Brooklyn?
Well, it was like my parent. Oh.
Long story.
Does this get edited or not?
No, but this sounds like the best part of the whole podcast coming up here.
Well, my parents are on the Upper West Side, and the triangulation was either we live in Brooklyn and spend more money on babysitting or spend more money on rent and then get more parental help with my one-year-old. So that's kind of how we netted out.
I'm familiar with the value of parents when you have a young child. Yes. I remember it well. Okay. Then you, it's possible that you are cool then. That's the reason you're living in Manhattan. All right. So, I mean, let's start with the China consensus. Now, here's the way I only yesterday actually heard it put by Evan Feigenbaum, someone I'm sure you're familiar with, well-known China scholar. Have you ever had him on your podcast?
I think so. He was an early guest, yeah.
Okay. So, the way he put it is, the way the U.S. has tended to talk about the region for about 15 years now is kind of China bad, allies good, yay quad, meaning what is that? Us, Australia. What is the quad? Us, Australia,
India,
and
Japan.
India, Japan. Yay quad, hooray Indo-Pacific, which is this, you know, kind of conceptualization of the region of significance that includes India. Xi Jinping, I'm quoting again, he goes on, Xi Jinping is a very, very bad man. Everybody fears China. Let's all get together. I guess he would say that's a little bit of a caricature, but do you think that captures the China consensus in a caricaturish way?
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of weird to even use the China consensus word now that like we kind of have a president who's not on board with it. Mm. So I would say, yeah, like let's call it like dominant narrative from 2014 to December 2024, I think was roughly what you were talking about, Rob. Bob, sorry. That the Xi Jinping is bad news. The U.S. can bring a sort of better 21st century around to itself and to the Asia Pacific by working with all of our democratic friends in the region to shape the sort of geopolitical landscape towards one that is more in favor of a liberal democratic vision than a China gets what it wants one.
Okay. There's a lot there. But the Trump thing is funny because to me, it's a little clear on any given day what his view of China will be, his view of anything will be, right? And it's funny, Trumpists were, I think, very much involved in shaping a hawkish China consensus. If you go back 5 years, I remember writing a piece about what Steve Bannon was saying on his podcast. Now, this was after COVID had started, and that, of course, kind of helped give momentum to the hawkishness, I would say. But I could see the Bannon was really latching on to it. They were going to make this a big issue in the election, and they did. But of course, 5 years ago in Trump time is like forever. I mean, he changes his mind much more often than that. But you see something kind of enduring in Trump's current view of China. I mean, on the one hand, he's slapping these, for a while was slapping these huge tariffs on China, which
let's just zoom out for a second. Yeah. I think this is probably the right way to start. So we have Trump 2, and we've had a relatively clear policy, I think, when it comes to Europe and NATO, with this very strong messaging that it's your guys' responsibility to take care of your region, deter Russia, deal with Ukraine. This is not going to be on the American taxpayers' ledger. And, you know, for all of the awkwardness and disjuncture that that line of thinking has from the past, 75 years of the way the U.S. is related towards Europe, it does make sense in that, like, the EU's GDP dwarfs what Russia can bring to the table. So the kind of logic that the Trump world has about this is like, look, if we tell them that we're not doing anything for them besides being a nuclear umbrella, and it's their job to sort of have the conventional forces to deter Russia from invading Poland or Estonia, like, they can do it. But sort of the collective balance of national power when you're talking about China versus the Philippines and Japan and South Korea and Vietnam, as opposed to Russia versus France and Germany and the UK and Poland, is very different, such that, like, you can't quite play the same, you can't quite map on the same strategy and expect to have similar results, because China kind of already does, without the U.S. involved, dwarf a lot of the smaller countries in the region who themselves aren't organized in the way that NATO is in terms of this kind of collective defense characterization. So what we've seen so far over the past 6 months of Trump 2.0, at least, is a whole lot of mixed signals. On the one hand, you have officials like Pete Hegseth flying over saying, this region is our number one priority. We're going to spend a lot of money to defend Taiwan and keep the regional architecture, which is, remained for the past 50 or so years in order. And then on the other hand, you got a lot of weird stuff like these trade wars, like Trump wanting to sell AI chips to China, like Trump saying preventing the president of Taiwan from traveling through the U.S., which is something that Taiwanese leadership has done on lots of occasions, according over the course of Trump 1.0. So, look, it's not thought out, but it is sort of vibrating to sort of different harmonics than what we're used to over the past few years. And I think kind of what you mentioned about the COVID as a big clarifying point for Trump and for the Republican Party, I think is an important analog here, because, like, something is going to happen between the US and China, which will drive all of these discordant notes probably to something which is a little more consistent. Maybe that's a balloon, maybe that's a pandemic, maybe that's some sort of military provocation. But my take right now is that we're not in a very steady state, and that all of this sort of, like, messy noise isn't necessarily something that's going to stay for long.
Yeah, okay. So there's a lot there. I kind of largely agree about Trump. I mean, the other part of Trumpism driving them toward a kind of antagonism toward China is the whole narrative about why we lost jobs in the Midwest. And of course, China did play a role, there's no doubt about it. But anyway, it's more politically effective to blame them than to blame automation, say, which probably played an equal role. But it makes sense that Trump would kind of line up behind a hawkish consensus. As you suggested, it's not so clear he's going to deliver in the way a lot of DC hawks would like. He has this impulse, you know, to want to be a great world historical figure and I guess, you know, make peace and maybe forge rapprochement, which would be okay with me under certain, if done in a certain way. But let me examine, I guess so, in comparing this to Russia, the premise seems to be that in both cases, the goal is clearly containment, and the question is how we go about it. And I think this is where you and I start to differ. I mean, there are certain things I want to keep China from doing in the region that it might want to do, but my own view has long been, even before AI, my view was that there were enough critical issues demanding international cooperation that we can't really afford anything like a true Cold War, and we need to be working hard on new structures of international governance. And then AI just completely convinced me, because I just think if you look ahead 5-10 years, if you don't have some serious degree of international governance of AI, I think we're in very deep trouble. We don't need to argue about that right now. Well, actually, let me just quickly ask you, do you not buy that view, that AI is going to demand some significant amount of international agreement on rules of the road, some of it formal? We'll have to involve China because that's the other AI superpower. Does that make sense to you?
Lots of threads here. Let me just close the loop on the Putin, Xi, Trump stuff, and then we'll come to AI. So, mm-hmm. You know, what has been fascinating to watch is, yes, Trump has this disposition towards strongmen, kind of wants them to be his friend, and came into office saying, I want to make peace in Ukraine. And what Putin has shown him over the past 6 months is that he's not interested in it, and he would rather be kind of bombing children in Kyiv than coming to the table in the sort of deal that Trump has had envisioned, such that Trump has really soured on this and is now starting to threaten tariffs and new sanctions and is basically fed up with the guy. And Xi is smarter than Putin and kind of has not played as aggressive a hand to ultimately repel Trump to want to coming to a deal. So the sort of rare earths move of in response to America's tariffs has been something that Trump has seen and recognized and like pulled back from the brink, as opposed to seeing that and wanting to escalate. So look, like, we'll just have to see if there is a global development or she has a misstep that ends up pissing off Trump, because that really feels to me to be like the one variable that matters in particular for the US-China relationship. Like, we've had so many advisors like denuded of power, and this is something that Trump personally cares about. So it's really going to be him making the calls. But all right, let's talk about AI. So, you know, the premise.
Actually, okay. Could we put that off and get back to the premise that containment should be the goal? This will naturally, I think, segue into AI, because I'm curious as to what your nightmare scenario is. Like, if we fail to contain China, first of all, kind of, regionally, geopolitically, but also in the sense of failing to, quote, win the AI race. But as for the first part, like conventional regional containment, you not that long ago had on your podcast Ezra Klein and Derek Thompson, and I want to get back to that for another reason. And you also had a guest named Dan Wang, I think it is. Is that how you pronounce the last name? He said of China, they surely want Taiwan. And then he said, the big question is, and here's a quote, is the next step that they want to take Vietnam, the Philippines, and Japan? Now, I think, I don't want to go so far as to call that crazy. I think it's pretty close to crazy to think that Xi Jinping thinks can't wait to occupy Japan. Now, is it possible that a war in Taiwan could lead to a conflict with Japan that would lead to war with Japan, could lead to God knows what? Maybe, but I don't. How many serious China scholars are there who think, and you know, I've had China hawks on. I've had China hawks on, well, like Mearsheimer on the one hand, and Dmitry Alperovitch, you know, the guy who founded CrowdStrike and wrote a kind of a China hawk book, clearly China hawk. And he said, no, of course they don't want to take Japan. Most people I talk to say that. Is that kind of thing an actual concern of yours, that they want to conquer nations I mean, especially Japan. I mean, look, the Philippines, yeah. Vietnam, I think is more than they want to try to chew up and swallow personally. But God, Japan, that's crazy. But I think, but anyway, you think it's not, you think they may be, that may be on their menu?
Look, you know, conquering countries is one thing, you know, sort of imagining a PRC that turns into Imperial Japan circa, you know, 1942, seems, I would agree, very far-fetched today. Mm-hmm. But I think there are sort of lots of world states which don't involve Okinawa turning into a new province of China, which would be very uncomfortable for the world if sort of a Chinese leader in the line of Xi Jinping was able to sort of shape the region how he wanted. But I think the problem is that these are impossible to answer questions. The sort of the downside risk, the sort of risk matrix of being too worried on one side or being too complacent on the other, I think very much bends towards being overcautious. And I want to draw an analogy to the early, you know, to the early post-Cold War era, where the U.S. was trying to understand, you know, what Stalin's deal was and what he wanted the world to look like. And I asked this.
I think you said post-Cold War. Do you mean pre-Cold War?
Post-World War II. Yeah, post-World War II.
Oh, maybe you did say that. I'm sorry. Maybe I got it wrong.
I had Sergei Rodchenko, who you should also have on. He wrote this fantastic book called To Run the World, he actually grew up on the Sakhalin Islands and speaks both Russian and Chinese, which made for like a fascinating archival piece of scholarship. But I asked him, I was like, look, you know, there's a world, you know, there exists a universe where a Soviet leader after 1945 wants something very different than what the Cold War ended up being. But sort of America's more aggressive moves and Turkey and Greece and Iran end up sort of pushing them to have a much more confrontational vision of what the, you know, what relations between the Soviet Union and the U.S. have to be. And his answer to this is like, look, the fundamental problem is we don't really know what the other side is thinking. The other side may not even know what they're thinking or what they ultimately want. This was the case with Stalin. Even with the passage of all these years, we don't know what Stalin's ultimate ambitions were. Was he limited in his appetite, or would he stop until he was met with counterforce, or would he keep pushing? It sounds fantastic, but appetite comes with the eating. And if you're an American policymaker faced with this situation, how do we stop that? What's the most reasonable policy? And it seems to him, at least, that the most reasonable one was containment, where you push back on expansionist desires and force the other side to take this into account so they are deterred and limit their ambitions. But as a result, you end up with something like Cold War dynamics. And sort of my understanding is that there is, you know, at a very minimum, a double digit chance that China wants to reshape the world in a way that even you would feel is very uncomfortable. And to sort of fall into that is not something which would be prudent for the U.S. to do, particularly when there are all these other countries who are our treaty allies who are, you know, calling for the U.S. to not let this happen. I mean, it's not like the Philippines and Vietnam and Japan are sort of like wishing for, or Taiwan, of course, are sort of like wishing for us to sort of lend the space to China. So for those two reasons, it makes me really uncomfortable to kind of, you know, shrug your shoulders, say, it'll probably be fine and just go with the flow.
Okay. Can you elaborate a little, though, on what you envision happening that, as you put it, even I would object to? You said, they don't want to occupy Japan, but they could wind up exerting a kind of influence that would just be unacceptable. Like, what would that be like? What would they be doing?
Well, I mean, let's do some historical analogies. Okay. We have like different visions of spheres of influence. You have like an actual empire, right? Like an Austro-Hungarian or a Japanese imperial or a Soviet Union's kind of domain
and I think
over.
We ruled that out. But so what form of influence, what do you imagine China actually doing?
Okay.
Like, leave history aside for a second. What do you imagine China doing 5 years from now, if we're not tough enough, that wouldn't be occupying Japan, but which I would find unacceptable?
Well, I mean, I think sort of extracting political concessions along a lot of different angles. So like for the U.S. right now, right, they cut off rare earths and then Trump decided, I guess we need to keep selling them AI chips because otherwise we won't get our rare earths and we won't be able to build factories. So sort of having leverage over political systems such that they sort of bend towards less democratic visions or like the sort of internal politics of a Taiwan or a Japan ends up being shaped in a way that, doesn't reflect like a democratic will, but more a vision that the sort of the Chinese government decides is in its interest. I mean, I think broadly,
what would they want Japan to do that we wouldn't want Japan to do and would be really, really bad if Japan did? How would they use this leverage? Leaving aside the question of whether they haven't shown really much of a tendency to do that until we started denying them microchips, but leave that aside.
Well, that's actually not true. We can go all the way back to 2010 before the Xi era where they did a whole rare earth export ban on Japan, right? So for instance, right. Japan has a number of semiconductor manufacturing equipment companies, which would be very valuable to China's effort to indigenize its semiconductor manufacturing ecosystem, basically make a strong competitor to TSMC or Samsung or Intel. Right now, the Japanese government doesn't sell a number of machines to China because they're worried about China becoming increasingly dominant when it comes to the global semiconductor manufacturing chain. So that's a pretty straightforward one, right?
That strikes me as, in a certain sense, circular in that what you're worried about is China having the influence, I guess, that would, or power that would come with having an indigenous microchip factory. And I don't really think for any given country to be able to make microchips is bad in and of itself. What I'm waiting for is to hear, how do they use this influence in a way that is clearly inimical to American interests? Now, I think you would say, well, it is inimical to American interests for them to have indigenous advanced chip-making capabilities. But if you're going to say that, you're going to have to sketch it out because that in itself is not a bad thing. I mean, what form of actual influence does China ultimately exert that I find unacceptable?
Okay. Well, I mean, you started with the jobs thing, right? With Trump and hollowing out of America. I mean, is that like, I don't know, like, it's kind of hard for me. Like, I don't know what your worldview is or sort of what matters to you. So like, if I give you something and you say like, no, that doesn't count. I think semiconductors are really important. You just talked, you opened
they
this conversation.
They're important. The question is, what is inherently bad about China having the indigenous capability to make them? I think you have a scenario in mind. There's something they would do with that power. I mean, there's the Dario scenario, right? Maybe that's what you're thinking about, is Dario Amede saying, well, whoever gets the superintelligence first rules the world. So the Western democracies have to get to superintelligence first. Cut off the shipflow to China. We will bring them to their knees. We will establish military dominance. He literally talks this way. And then something good will happen, which I think is completely nuts, because if it's the case that superintelligence gives you world dominance, a war is going to start before we get the dominance. But Is that the scenario you have in mind with the chips?
I mean, it's a scenario. I think the sort of the broader question here is like, what percent of like global national power is the world, our Asian allies, is America like comfortable with China and a regime that looks like the way China looks like now holding, right? And I think like, you know, on the one hand, you have 1.5 billion people, many of whom are still very poor, who deserve to have lives that sort of are flourishing and, you know, have good healthcare and education and be able to kind of fulfill themselves.
Okay, but many fewer are poor as a result of past economic engagement with China. Now, that had a downside in America, as we've said, but I mean, come on, the policies that China hawks are championing are not going to reduce the number of poor people in China. If anything, it's more likely, and certainly Trump's
That's because you didn't let me finish the thought, which is why you got confused by it. Again, on the one side of the ledger, you have this this vision, which is positive for humanity, of this very big country and more people kind of being engaged in the global economic system and having their lives improved by that, both in China and in the world where we can buy cheap solar panels and electric vehicles and whatever. On the other hand, you have this regime who, you know, I cannot sketch out the sort of grand plan of dominance because apparently anyone I do you think is either like not realistic or infeasible. You know, does not sort of like is inherently a sort of nationalist ecos, you know, like has a very nationalist bent to it and does not, I think, really care all that much about the sort of like, you know, global peace and living standards improvement that you would maybe hope for them to do if you wanted to kind of focus on, you know, tackling like transnational challenges. So, you know, right now you can kind of slice up the world's like national power balance between a third China plus Russia plus assorted countries, a third the US on its own, and then the rest of the third, you know, maybe 15% of that is American treaty allies and then like a long tail of other countries who just don't give a shit. And you know, my contention to the EU is, you know, the world is very contingent. I cannot sort of like give you the Chinese influence operation battle plan of what the Chinese government wants to do with its allies, you know, with America's allies, you know, whether it wants to influence American elections like Russia did, or you know, whether it's just going to kind of sit back and be the sort of factory for the world and be totally comfortable if and when it swallows Taiwan, that like that is enough, right? You know, if you're going to take semiconductors as a thing that matters off the table, then there's just the kind of like broader feeling of uncomfortability with what the Chinese government has done when it comes to supporting autocrats around the world, which I, for one, am not a super fond of. And I think, you know, having China's support of Russia through its war in Ukraine is another data point which I would find to be pretty concerning. But you know, if we're going to sort of trust fall into the world where my one third split changes over into like China is 50% and then the US is down to 25%, I think the sort of like range of outcomes for the planet I am more uncomfortable with than the range of outcomes where the balance stays relatively consistent over time and the amount of leverage that has allowed all of the sort of swing countries that we're talking about to basically like choose their own destiny or be under the American defense umbrella, which they, you know, all these countries, as far as I can tell, have been pretty happy with over the past 75 years to continue as it has. I mean, look, like we haven't had a great power. And I think the big worry, Rob, is something that tips over into a great power conflict. And this is sort of the other debate we should be having is like, what is the American strategy here, which is going to have the highest probability of avoiding a war as opposed to leading us into one. Because, mm-hmm. you know, okay, say that like great power, say that national power balance goes 3% this way or 5% this way, or AI drags it in one direction or the other, like that's all fine. But if it gets to a point where one country freaks out or thinks that they have a real opportunity to sort of squeeze and take a dramatic, roll the iron dice, then we're in a really scary place. And my contention to you is that keeping those sort of like balances relatively equal or having them trend in the U.S. and its allies' favor over time is going to make it less likely for a Chinese government today or tomorrow to start a war than it would be if the sort of the Chinese power and its confidence that it could win a war easily ends up waxing.
Well, I certainly agree that imbalances of power can be destabilizing, and one of the ones I worry about is the one that we seem to be systematically pursuing, which is to say, and this is more or less Trump's policy, and it's what Dario is recommending, and so far as I can tell, it's what a lot of people in the AI community are fine with, which is we are going to pursue artificial superintelligence. We are going to cut off China's chips, and I could explore further how that looks to China. And I think we should do a better job of like trying to put ourselves in their shoes, if only out of our own self-interest. And then we believe that superintelligence is going to give us total world dominance and military dominance. And that's what we're after. They can't even have chips, certain chips designed by their own companies that were being made in this, in Taiwan, which of course they consider their own and even we don't recognize as a sovereign country and so on. Like, if you think we can keep doing that without them, for starters, invading Taiwan, without us at least sharply increasing the probability that they invade Taiwan, now that we've set up this situation where we get the greatest benefits from those factories in Taiwan, they no longer do. They used to, and at that point, those factories were kind of a deterrent to invasion. But no, now we're no longer doing that, and that's a policy you favor, I know, and that manifestly increases the chances that China would invade Taiwan under the circumstances I'm describing. So we share an aversion to creating forms of asymmetry that clearly invite global apocalypse. I just think the scenario you seem to be championing is one of those. Now, I want to quickly add, just as an asterisk on a separate note, and then you can respond to whatever you want. But the when you said, we don't know. It's uncertain. China may do this. They may do that. They may do that. I agree with the uncertainty. What I want to know is, what do the paths lead to that we should find unacceptable? And you started to articulate some of that when, for example, you said, now maybe they will interfere with U.S. elections. Now, again, I would ask, what's going to make them most likely to interfere with U.S. elections? Like, if we're all on the same page, there's economic engagement, cooperation, or if, you know, we seem to be a hostile power that's pursuing superintelligence so that we can dominate them and bring them to their knees and get them to renounce their form of government, which is literally what Dario wants. I might ask, like, which is more likely to get them to interfere in elections? But I just want to say, that's the kind of answer I'm looking for. So thank you for that. That is something that you would consider bad. Another thing you mentioned is them supporting autocratic governments. Again, in my own view, I don't see any evidence that that is an ideological imperative of China. I said when Biden showed up with his democracy versus autocracy paradigm, I said this is going to be a self-fulfilling prophecy. And I think that is what we've seen. More and more, yes. I mean, if we define all the autocratic nation, well, the ones that it's not convenient to not define that way, like some in the Middle East. Anyway, if we define a lot of them as the enemy and sanction most of them, of course they're going to be more and more in league. And look, of course, China will sell its surveillance software to anybody who'll buy it, of course. But that's different from there being an ideological imperative. So anyway, thanks for starting to sketch out some of the consequences you fear. That's what I'm looking for.
Yeah,
and then we disagree on what gets the world blown up and what doesn't.
Yeah. Okay. So let's do that. Let's stay on the consequences. I'll give you a more direct answer. All right. I think it is important for everyone to understand that without China's support of Russia over the past 3 years, the war in Ukraine would be over. Russia would not be able to support itself. It would have gotten broke. No one would have been able to buy, you know, it would have had nowhere to buy its oil. It's getting all these drone supplies. That is a very big data point of like a really, really like globally obnoxious thing that has led to hundreds of thousands of deaths that China, that Xi Jinping, who's talked about, Russia as like, you know, closer than a brother, has basically thrown them this enormous lifeline to pursue, you know, the most globally a destructive war, in decades. So like, you know, we can sort of wish cast our way past that. But the fact that they have been the most important global accomplices to the most horrific war we've seen in decades is an important thing to price in as we're thinking about just how far-fetched the sort of machinations in East Asia and Southeast Asia could be. So let's talk about sort of influence operations, because I think this isn't
the support of Russia an existential threat to America. In fact, a long, long way from it. And my own view, just as an asterisk,
but it's not great.
We could have avoided the war if we had a better foreign policy, A, and B, we could have brought it to an end if we did. And, but I agree, I'd rather them not be giving them drones and stuff. But Ukraine? Wait, aren't a lot of Ukrainian drones coming from China too?
Russia is like, China is a strategic partner of Russia. They have given them this enormous like economic lifeline in the hundreds of billions of dollars. They've become their most important trading partner. And yeah, there are some secondhand sellers of drone parts that are able to make it from China to Ukraine, because this is a globally liquid market. I don't think this is really a comparable point, but broader, like whatever you think, whatever you want about U.S. policy towards Ukraine. But the fact of the matter is, like, you can't just, like, China could have ended this war at any point over the past 3 years by telling Putin it was going to cut them off. And they haven't, because they're kind of okay with it, or they see it in their interests. Yeah, and as we're sort of building our conception of the types of regimes that China could be or turn into over the past, you know, over the next 5, 10, 20 years, it's very important to have this as a data point in your head that this is a regime which finds it in its interest to have a war which has killed 100,000, you know, hundreds of thousands of people, be something that they are actively kind of encouraging and egging on. You've literally had Wang Yi go to the...
Goal is to sustain the war. Whether that's the reason they're supporting Russia,
Wang Yi has literally said that. There was a quote in the Financial Times. I'll pull it up if you want to cut the graph. But, you know, he spoke, he was meeting with the EU 2 months ago, who was like, look, he literally said this. We could have ended this war tomorrow, but we think it's our interest to have, to have this continue. So anyways,
I wouldn't call it an existential threat, even to Western Europe. I mean, Russia's not, but anyway, fine. Let's put that aside. I'm not arguing that it wouldn't be better.
I'm trying to get into your worldview, but if you think like this war is fine, it's sort of hard. And I think the other
Did I say this war is fine?
Well, it's just like not important, like not relevant.
We're talking about a relationship with the other global superpower, the country with whom war would be most catastrophic. And we have a disagreement of what our approach should be. And you seem to be saying that, granted, you know, there are real downsides doing certain things, but we have to keep in mind the grave threat that China poses to American interests. I think that's your argument. If it's not, correct me. And I'm just saying that, look, the Ukraine war, I think, A, look, Russia invaded. They're the ones who committed the crime. That's a violation of international law. I've been consistent about that. War is horrible. What's happening in Gaza is horrible, which we're, you know, providing the weapons for free. There's, you know, and by the way, which is worse? What China is doing in Ukraine or us providing the weapons for free that have killed 1 in 35 Gazans?
We're getting too far afield.
Well,
here.
No, I mean, this, you're saying like, this is such a fundamental indictment of China that, you know, kind of all bets are off. Is it worse than what we do?
Well, I mean, like, okay, we're doing worse. Therefore, I don't know where you go with that. Fine. Okay. Like, America's like,
well,
then
I
what?
Mean, if like, China. If China is no more menacing than the United States, your whole premise is that China is bad and menacing in a way the U.S.
look,
isn't.
Look, if you don't buy the premise that a world order where America has more of a say than an autocratic regime, then like I don't know where we go with this conversation, because like I think that is like at a level of sort of values. You know, there's a conversation at a level of values that I'm not equipped to discuss. So I'm going to just take that as a premise and you can question it all you want and we can sort of move on from there. On the sort of other things that I don't know what else I got for you. If sort of you were writing off Ukraine as like not that big a deal, but some other ones of world states that China could, a more confident, aggressive China with more leverage over countries could manifest. I think one of the storylines which hasn't quite penetrated the Western media ecosystem, the American media ecosystem at least, is the extent of influence operations that the Chinese government has pursued in Australia, in Taiwan, in Japan, and in the Philippines, where sort of what Russia has done in the U.S. context over the past, decade or so is kind of like pretty weak sauce compared to, you know, having politicians on payroll, buying sort of media organizations and coverage, doing harassment of advocates and intellectuals and writers, and really trying to sort of like shape elections in the country's favor, both from these sort of like both from this kind of undercurrent of meddling in democratic local and national processes, as well as using this broad panoply of economic coercion when it comes to imports or tariffs to put pressure on various democratic countries to, you know, stop talking about Xinjiang, not let people in from Hong Kong, a whole number of sort of political priorities. I mean, the Chinese government literally made a list of 10 demands to Australia that were all sort of like political in nature. You know, stop criticizing us. Stop. Don't write a report about the Uyghurs and labor. In order to like continue to buy their iron ore. And I think if we have a world where the sort of amount where like that is just okay, then it gets to be a lot more uncomfortable. And I think, you know, one of the coming back to our top level thing of like I guess this isn't really in Trump's ecosystem, but one of the things I would like to think that the US stands in favor of is sort of democratic countries being able to like follow the paths that their people choose. And that being something that China is like obviously not uncomfortable with, and even being less powerful than it may be 5 or 10 or 20 years down the road, has tried to sort of play these cards. I can imagine much more aggressive and successful attempts to sort of shape speech environments, sort of political priorities of other countries, not just the U.S., but also broader, more broadly in the region, that a more empowered China that has 50% of, you know, global national power could potentially pull off.
Yeah, I'm not happy with China meddling in our political system or anybody else's trying to suppress speech or shaped speech or shaped the discourse. Again, I think they're going to do a lot more of that to the extent that we are perceived as hostile to their interests. And I believe the policies you favor ensure that we'll be perceived that way. So that's a very important point of a difference between us.
Well, here's the thing. Let me add quickly.
I assume you're aware that the U.S., and I'm not saying these are identical or symmetrical or precisely comparable or even equal in magnitude, but I assume you know the U.S. has a long history in interfering of the internal politics of other nations, including democracies, and trying to shape the outcome of elections. Some of the ways we do it seem perfectly benign to us, may not seem so there. I mean, some countries, you know, when we're funding a lot of, you know, what we call civil society organizations, see that as interference, whatever. We've also supported flat-out coups and so on. So we've done a lot of that. So I wouldn't call that a sharp qualitative difference between our approach to the world and theirs. So, that's kind of a point. We've had
a Maoist China which funded, you know, armed revolutions around the world. I think everyone did a lot of dirty stuff in the Cold War. And by the way, like, we had a church commission, we had a U.S. public that kind of rejected these sorts of dirty tricks over the 50s and 60s and 70s into the 80s and 90s. And like, I don't think that stuff has happened for a long time now. But let's say, I want to come back to this, like, to what extent can America's actions actually shape sort of the Chinese worldview of the relation between the U.S. and China? Because I think you will grant me that, you know, from basically 1973 until 2010, America was China's best friend. We were instrumental in them, you know, technologically upgrading, even militarily upgrading. We sold them a lot of weapons in the 70s and 80s as the Sino-Soviet split developed. And sort of still, and I would encourage you to read The Long Game by Rush Doshi, who documents this in very kind of compelling detail, talking about the Chinese strategic conception that, like, we had 40 years of America crossing our fingers and hoping that the sort of outstretched palm that we showed the CCP in terms of sort of economic engagement and technological transfer would end up leading to a more amicable relationship between the two countries. But even in the 90s, you have Jiang Zemin and into Hu Jintao talking about how America is our number one enemy and our adversary. And, you know, once we get the strength, we're going to challenge them on all fronts. And that is a logic where Xi Jinping comes to office in 2012, basically says the same exact thing. Again, this is in the sunny lands, you know, Obama first term era, where the sort of China consensus, which you're characterizing, hadn't even materialized, that they sort of saw American, America's place in the world and the values that it espoused as, for all intents and purposes, a Cold War that China needed to fight. So I just kind of reject the premise that America being sort of marginally nicer to the Chinese government is going to get them to sort of reshape their vision of what the U.S. means in the world. And if that's not the case, then sort of what we are losing on the other side of this is, you know, a free and independent Taiwan, a free and independent Philippines, a free and independent Vietnam, a free and independent Japan. You know, we can debate about just how bad it's going to get for them when a fully empowered China wants to do whatever it wants to do in the region. But I do think that you need to kind of, like, very much, like, if we're going to change policies, which is going to allow China to have more sort of national power and influence on the region and more technology and more more advancements, then you have to get something on the other side of that. And I think the lesson of the past, of the post-Mao era in U.S.-China relations is actually not that sort of engaging in a more gentle way wins over the Chinese political establishment. Instead, this is something that they have pocketed and then sort of used to sort of grow national power and become more aggressive on the world stage, not less of aggressive and kind of thankful and wanting to be a responsible actor on the on the global stage, which I think the sort of Ukraine case is the most strident example of.
Okay. A couple of things. On the issue of a world in which there's not a free and independent Japan, again, this is kind of an asterisk, but I await someone sketching out a plausible scenario by which Japan loses its freedom and independence because we, continue to let China import H-20s or something. I'm not advocating withdrawing American troops from Japan.
But we on Taiwan? Like, do you care enough? Like, do them being like a sort of independent democratic polity, like, are we going to write that off like Ukraine of like, oh, this isn't America's interest? Or for you, like, where does it stand
I didn't write off Ukraine. I've repeatedly talked about how we could A, end the war, B, could have avoided it. These things matter a lot to me. Let me say a couple of things. So anyway, I kind of await those scenarios about how Japan loses its independence. Unless we just like totally vacate the area. When you say, that I'm saying if we're marginally nicer to China, I think everything will work out. Well, no, I don't. You have to be a tough bargainer all the way along. But an example of what I'd like to see at a minimum is for people who favor the chip restrictions and not just like the H-200s, but, you know, everybody's up in arms about China relaxing the ban on the H-20s, which, of course, as you know, we're in compliance with the restrictions we set down. Then Trump impulsively decided to ban them. What I want to see is somebody tell me, what is the end game? What do we want from China? I mean, are we ever going to say, okay, you can have the advanced chips, even assuming this is working as opposed to spurring the development of China's indigenous infrastructure for making chips, which I think is actually what it's doing. But even assuming it worked, like, what is the end game? If I heard an appreciable number of people say, here's the end game. We recognize the importance of the international governance of AI, and we just want to lure China into a structure that involves significant transparency and on and on and on, and the things that it'll take to keep the world safe as AI progresses. I'd love to hear that. I don't hear it.
Like, the problem of the mental model that I think the people who agree with you have is that I would encourage you to like have more guests on to just interrogate what this regime is and what its ambitions are and what it values and what it doesn't. So like talking about sort of China's ambitions with AI.
Okay, before who do you recommend? I will literally write down the names and approach them. Who should I have on?
Okay. I think Jeff Ding might be a good one. Okay. Divyansh Kaushik, another. Matt Sheehan, third. But you know, like, she talks
okay,
a lot.
My turn. You should have Paul Triolo, and you should have Kaiser Guo of Seneca. Do we agree? Have we reached rapprochement? Is there peace in our time between our two podcasts? Can we?
I find it uncomfortable. Like,
okay. Anyway,
the thing about one of those two guests is a lot of their clients are Chinese, so it makes it hard for me to sort of by the political arguments that they're making
And have you examined the funding of all the think tanks of all the guests on your podcast? Come on, everybody's got all this shit going on. But anyway, go ahead. Or are any of your guests getting Pentagon funding? Or funding from Silicon Valley?
Is this fun? Are we enjoying this here? You can ask me questions and I can answer them, or you can talk about stuff and I can say I disagree. I don't know. I don't feel like we're giving a lot to the audience here right now. I feel bad as a guest.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry that I've done that. Okay. But go ahead.
I don't know. Prompt me. Where do you want to take this?
Well, let me say the other thing I wanted to say before we go into overtime. And folks, if you thought this was interesting, on the larger point, I think you want to eventually get to Taiwan. What I just said, if you want to remember, maybe this was your train of thought, was about, was I think about chip restrictions. But a point I want to make about something you said earlier, which is that if I want, if I'm willing to live with a world in which an autocratic regime has more influence in the world than the U.S., I was like you don't know where we can, you know, find common ground. So let me just be clear. I'm enough of a realist to think that in the real world, the influence that nations have is going to be fairly closely correlated to their economic and military power. China is a very big country with a lot of brain power, and they're going to be very influential. And we can't wish that away. And I don't think we have the ability to stunt their development anyway, in a way that doesn't lead to war or something, that we don't wind up with a very influential China. So I think we just have to kind of live with that. And as for, and you know, I have a way I want to do it.
So
I have a way,
so
I have an approach. But I want to add, the autocratic part depends on something we haven't interrogated much, which is, I think you and probably most people in China consensus think that it is China's ideological aspiration to create more autocratic nations, including, I guess, convert ours into one. I don't see the evidence for that. I could be wrong, but that's an it's an important part of my worldview that I don't consider that established.
Okay. Well, just let's go again. Rush Doshi, you did his PhD on this topic. This is
I've invited him, by the way. He didn't reply. I invited him, but go ahead.
Look, I think my end game is recognizing, China's big, China's not going anywhere, but the sort of relative balance of national power is something that I think America and democracies around the world should try to preserve. And that can manifest in a lot of ways, by investing in militaries, by investing in research and development, by letting immigrants come to places they could be more productive, by strengthening relationships with allies, by encouraging allies to invest in their own sort of technological, economic, and military development. And the sort of the downsides that the downside scenarios that you get for not pursuing those types of things because you're worried about pissing off China are worse than the downside scenarios you get where you don't do those things and China ends up with an extra 5 or 10% of like global national power. So that is kind of my end game is, I think sort of overthrowing the CCP is a kind of ridiculous thing to point through. Point two, I think that being your end game in 1948 is like, you know, there's so much happened. There's so much that happened between then and 1989, 1990, that it's kind of silly to like point to that as a lodestar. But I think kind of having this vision of an America and sort of democratic partners around the world that can have more of a say in the way the world plays out and for whatever things are going to come down the pipe, which I think it's kind of hard to even predict over a 10, 20, 50 year cycle. I mean, we're just talking about AI, like who the hell knows what AI is going to turn out to be, but I would much more trust sort of democratic polities around the world to make those calls about what this technology should or shouldn't do than, you know, the Chinese State Council or the one person running China. And I think that is my lodestar where, you know, making executives at Chinese countries or Xi Jinping upset because they can't buy the latest you know, graphics card out of NVIDIA is a less, you know, is not as high on my priority list as ensuring that balance of power. And insofar as these chips are, but you know, potentially one of the variables which may end up mattering for that global national balance of power thing, I would rather run the risk of making the Chinese government a little more upset, which I actually don't think is as big of a risk because I think they already don't trust America, then kind of give them another draw on the river to allow a few extra points of national power to swing in Beijing's direction.
Yeah, I'm not worried about making them upset. I'm worried about making them feel existentially threatened, which has a history of leading to bad things. But something else I was going to say, but I don't know what it was. So we're going to go into, as I said, we're going to go into overtime. You've graciously agreed, unless you've had second thoughts since you graciously agreed, spend some time in a conversation that is available to our paid subscribers at the Non-Zero newsletter. And all you have to do to become one of those is go to the Non-Zero newsletter, and you can click on the post that represents this podcast, and you'll have access to that. And you can watch it right there, but you can also get the special code that always gives you access to the overtimes on the podcast.
Can I pick up the Pentagon funding thing? Okay. So I think like that's a fair point you make. But again, I want to come back to the, like, are you more comfortable with an America or a China, which like has a better, 20 years on the global stage? And yes, everyone has to like make a living from somewhere, right? But I think the sort of biases that you end up being like, and yes, I think everyone has biases, but I would be more comfortable with my information coming through the lens of someone who like believes in the American project. Versus someone who's paid like to not have that be as their lodestar. Is that fair?
What I'd say is, let's just get funding from AI, American AI companies, Silicon Valley companies, compared to getting it from China companies. Do I want to just listen to people that want to make Sam Altman happy and encourage a breakneck AI race with like no regulation and massive government subsidy? No, because I think that leads to authoritarianism. I think that leads to the destabilization of American society, A, and B, of the world, and C, actually makes it more likely, because nothing favors authoritarian takeover like disorder. And I think AI is going to be so disruptive that if we let the Silicon Valley gods continue to compel us to put no inhibitions on them whatsoever, no restraints whatsoever, and in fact, subsidize their consumption of energy, notwithstanding climate change, I think that it's my view that that is actually more likely to lead to my children living in an authoritarian system. I could be wrong, or living amid chaos. I could be wrong, but the broader point is, everyone gets their money from somewhere, and usually it's in some sense corrupting. And I also would say that the American like media ecosystem seems to me so shut off from understanding even how things are being processed in China, how things look from China, that if listening to somebody who's getting money from a Chinese company corrects that balance somewhat, that's not a bad thing. And finally, if you ask, why do I seem so excited about all this, so agitated? First of all, I take that as a compliment, because you have one of the highest energy podcasts I've ever heard. And I want to thank you for letting me rise to somewhere near your level of normal energy. But the reason is I'm so damn frustrated by the fucking China hawk consensus. Okay, sorry. Go ahead. Yeah, before we go into overtime, I will give you totally the last word and encourage people to listen to China Talk, which is justly listened to by many, many people.
Yeah, I guess to show my show, like, I usually like, I like asking the questions a lot more than answering them.
More of a debate. You thought I should have just asked questions and then let you answer and moved on to the next
question. Oh, no, I don't know. I just like, I spend like 90% of my time like trying to investigate, and then maybe 10% of my time trying to like quote unquote evangelize. And I think this sort of search is much more interesting than the destination as a broad broadly. So yeah, I mean, these are like interesting times, and I don't blame you for doing that. I think it's an interesting show. I don't know. I feel like I'm a good avatar of a viewpoint. I'm a guy who's much more comfortable asking questions than answering them. So maybe that's why I was like kind of a little off today.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry if I didn't let you answer any questions, but I think contention does highlight differences usefully. I like constructive debate. Sure. And I'm sorry.
The thing you kept hitting on of like, what is the concrete vision of mm-hmm. what China is going to do to the world that the world is uncomfortable with? Like there's not a master plan that you can see. But I think there is, and this is something that is a constant, like, this is a real question that you're asking. And I think there, you know, the answers that people give who believe this stuff even more strongly than I do are necessarily like a little amorphous, because it hasn't happened yet, because China hasn't been powerful enough to really sway its weight in a way to manifest its vision. But I think if you kind of dive into the Rush Doshi source documentation of all of this sort of foreign policy visions that not just Xi, but leaders before him, and you know, this is setting aside Mao's kind of like vision of global revolution, had, it is one that I think you and your audience would be uncomfortable with. And maybe for next time I'll come, you know, bearing more quotes to this to a conversation like this. But it's hard to sort of like, it's hard to like discuss things that like haven't happened yet in world states that don't exist. But the fundamental thing that I come back to here is like for all like liberal democracies faults, I have more faith in this sort of system than a Leninist one, being the one that makes the big calls which are going to shape the future of the 21st century. And I think sort of like hoping on an empowered China to like make the right calls for the world about, you know, super powerful AI, if that's the thing you're worried about, is not really realistic. If you just sort of read and engage with how she talks about when it comes to AI and national power, that it is a vehicle for sort of like, national strengthening and military dominance, not something that he's like worried about killing us all or kind of worried about helping the world with. I mean, this is like
That's the way we talk about it too. And I'm not talking about letting China write the rules. I'm talking about a cooperative relationship. We're a very powerful nation. We have a lot of leverage. And again, if some of these people who favor chip controls would say, well, here's our end game. We're trying to steer China toward this, as opposed to saying, we're trying to get to, we just want to bring China to her knees, or not even talking about what's going to happen in the end. I feel a lot better. Okay, I once spent some time in overtime, and we haven't talked about Taiwan, so we'll do that in overtime. But it would be uncharitable of me not to surrender the next 30 seconds to you to say whatever you want. And I promise, all I'll say after that is, we're going to overtime. I will not respond. Go ahead.
ChinaTalk.media. I think it's pretty good. Anyways, all right, let's dive in.
It is good. Okay, we're going into overtime.